Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Welcome to another edition of Off Camera, the show where I get to talk to iconic, creative, curious artists and find out how they got that way. And in this episode, I sit down with comic, writer, and actor Nick Kroll. You know, when someone walks into the studio wearing a fake beard, talking about how much he hates artifice, what's not to love, right? Nick has made a career of creating some of the most outrageously funny characters in modern sketch comedy. If you watched his Comedy Central series, Kroll Show, you've met many of them. Bobby Bottle Service, Fabrice, the fabulous Liz G of publicity, and maybe most famously, Gil Faison, who ended up on Broadway along with John Mulaney's George St. Geeglin as the 70-year-old out-of-touch comedy duo in Oh Hello on Broadway. And now he's created Big Mouth, the best animated show about puberty your preteen could ever watch, and one you will never let them anywhere near. But here's the thing. It captures one of the most unsettling and formative times of our life in a way that's really funny, completely relatable, and quite disturbing. I highly recommend it to adults, especially those of us with kids on the verge. Anyone who says puberty isn't the stuff of high drama is either lying or still waiting for body hair. Nick was the only one of his siblings not to enter a very successful family business. What made him try to carve out artistic success on his own terms? Turns out there's a lot of answers to that question. Join me for a conversation with one of the most original minds in comedy. Unless you love A Prairie Home Companion, then this might not be the episode for you. Otherwise, pull up a chair and listen in.
Hi, Nick.
Hi. Hi, Sam.
Thanks for doing this.
Thank you for having me.
What are you going to sing for us today?
Oh, I think I'm going to sing, do you know the song Working 9 to 5?
Yeah, the explicit version or the clean?
Yeah.
Wouldn't that be terrible if I didn't prep you for that and you're supposed to sing a song?
And I'm like, oh, you found the one performative art that I am genuinely uncomfortable doing.
Is that true?
Kind of. I mean, there's probably a lot of performative things that I actually find uncomfortable or nerve-wracking. But singing is like, as a someone who is a live performer, singing is the scariest to me. And the thing I'm, yeah.
That's interesting. You know, my kids have seen or heard you sing on a loop ever since Sing came out.
Really? Yeah.
Because they love that movie.
Yeah.
But you'd have to have some singing ability to be able to do that.
For me, personally speaking, and that's the only way I'm going to speak today with you.
You're not going to speak impersonally?
No, I won't speak impersonally or from other people's point of view. I will only speak from my point of view.
I'm glad we got that out of the way so you don't have to say in my opinion.
Yeah,
the whole
in
time.
My opinion, yes. However, what I will say now lightly contradicts what I've just said, which is I find it easier to sing in character than to do it as myself. Because
right.
Either you can hide behind the character's voice, or I think it's really more than anything. I mean, there are people who can sing and people who can't sing. And then there are people who are comfortable singing. And a huge part of singing, I think, is just the appearance of ease, comfort, and confidence. So if I'm singing as a character, I know what that character's voice does, or, you know, the rules of that voice, and I'm weirdly more comfortable singing that as that character. Even like, because doing characters is singing in its own way, but in my mind, I'm like, no, that's different. Singing is a different thing.
Did you ever take yourself seriously as a singer or try to do it as yourself?
I mean, over the years, like, I don't like karaoke. I mean, I like going to karaoke. I like watching people sing. And I like drinking soju and getting hungover for weeks.
At karaoke.
Yeah. And I don't like soju, but I do. I don't love that I'm not that comfortable doing it. But I, for whatever reason, singing in Sing, the voice is a silly voice, and it's like so weirdly. It's the only way I could imagine singing that song.
Really?
It's like I'm singing Shake It Off by
Taylor Swift.
Taylor Swift. And then there's another song, like a disco song that is now escaping because you have kids, you listen to like the Spotify of that album or something like that.
Yes, we do.
I really.
Well, and we watched the movie over and over again.
It's such a sweet movie.
And was that something that, like, how do you get a gig like that?
That one came kind of out of the blue. I got a call being like, there's this like European pig. To dance and sing alongside Reese Witherspoon in a movie. And I was like, okay, I'll do it. I've always wanted for like a Jewish boy to play a German pig is like a dream, is the dream of all dreams. But the director, Garth Jennings, had seen, I had a sketch show called Kroll Show, and I did a European character on there. And he had heard that voice and was like, could you do something in that accent? And then I added the, you know, this, the European guy sort of, you know, for breakfast will do two free cigarettes, a bowl of heavy cream.
I remember that guy from the Kroll Show. That's right. And he hosted a show. And
yeah, and it got great. And then he became sort of a cannibal in the later seasons. But Garth heard that and then was like, could you do something like that? But like, you know, for a pig. And so it became like this. You know, it was like sort of a similar accent and then a different voice.
And was there ever a question of singing, or did he care?
That, no, it came up somewhere in the middle where he called and was like, hey, Nico, it would be wonderful if you could sing this. And I was like, okay, I'll try. It was, that's all. I went in and we sang it. And that's kind of the beauty of autotune a little bit. This is the first time I really realized, like, oh, they can really make something sound.
Right.
Because I can hear that where they've digitized my voice.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Or where they found another guy and you don't even know about it.
I have a European pig sound alike.
You know, he comes with you in every movie contract.
Yeah, it's like how Eddie Murphy has a stand-in, like whenever he's not saying words, like the stand-in is there for Eddie, basically.
Right.
I have that with a European pig voice guy.
Well, that's good.
It's great.
Yeah, you know, when I think of your history at Kroll Show, I mean, you've played women and old men and I don't even know what you call Bobby Bottle Service, but you play people that have no shame. Like, in that show, one thing that ties all those characters together is none of them have any shame, right? And so it got me thinking, and it's interesting to hear you say that singing is the one place that feels awkward, because my question to you would be, if you ever feel embarrassed anymore, like, can you still get embarrassed?
The answer is yes and no. I think I have, like, I'm the youngest of four, and I credit a lot of, I'm going to say fearlessness, but that's not the right word, but, like, the ability to be like, fuck it, I'll try it, to being, like, the youngest, because you just are exposed to, like, older kids and stuff, and you just get to do stuff younger.
Right.
And you're always just like, oh, cool, what are we doing now? All right, we're all doing this. Like, I think that's a real advantage that, like, youngists have.
So you think you took that into this career?
I took that into all the stuff. Like, my little philosophy leaving college when I moved to New York and was like, I'm going to go do comedy, was that regret was a lot scarier to me than rejection.
That's a really mature viewpoint at that age. Like, to even think about the concept of regret at college age.
Yeah, it was really like right after college when I was like, I think I'm going to try this because I think I can do it. And then I signed with this great brand manager, and he gave me that quote that regret is a lot. I'm kidding. That would be amazing.
I was a lot more amazed with you like 32 seconds ago.
Yes, before.
And now some brand manager wrote that line.
Yeah, exactly. Which I think was like the worst way to follow. It's just a constant undercutting of genuine moments.
Yes.
But I think I just had this thing of like, I don't know if I can, like, I don't know if I can be a comedian. I don't know if I'm going to get to be an actor, because I've been very fortunate in my life, my lovely family, very supportive in all ways. And so it's not like I've had a tough road to hoe. But I do think doing all this kind of stuff, you can't, if you're not good and you don't work very hard, then you just don't succeed, I don't think. I don't know many people doing in my space who aren't very good at what they do. And
sure.
And so I was like, I don't know if I will be good enough to do this, but I know that if I don't try it, I will be like lifelong bummed out. And so most things I do end up being able to have that some version of a trigger of that moment that then is like, okay, I'm doing a movie right now called Uncle Drew with I don't know if this is where my fear comes in. I'm like, am I supposed to talk about a movie that I'm shooting right now that hasn't come? Am I going to get cut out of this movie?
And then
this airs, and I'm the laughing stock.
Do you know there's that black and white show where Nick Kroll thought he was going to be in a movie?
Yeah, and then he wasn't.
And he's only been in like 36 movies, and now he wasn't in this
one? Yeah, that guy's a nobody. So, but it's this movie. It's Kyrie Irving, the basketball player, Cavaliers, in old man makeup.
What if he gets cut?
That would be amazing. That would be a true and genuine embarrassment on his part. But I don't think he'll get cut because he's like super good. It's a very funny video they made like 5 years ago. It went viral. And he plays like an old man who is incredibly good at basketball. So the movie is about like the Rucker tournament class, like a big streetball tournament in New York.
Okay.
This movie's sort of like White Men Can't Jump meets like Grumpy Old Men or something weirdly like that.
Right.
And so I've been down there shooting, and it's like Kyrie Irving, Shaq, Reggie Miller, Chris Webber, Lisa Leslie, Nate Robinson. I mean, like,
legends. Yeah.
So we're shooting some stuff.
I literally
might get cut out of this. But at the very least, even if I get cut out of it, I enter the game at one point, my character. I'm the coach of another team.
Okay.
And so I had some free play basketball with, like, those guys. And I was, like, with, like, 500 extras watching. And it was very scary. In Atlanta, and I was like, all of these black people are watching me play basketball. If I can be so bold, it's a black and white show. Let's talk about race.
Yeah, right there.
And so I started doing free play with them. And these, I mean, the last time I seriously played basketball was like eighth grade Jewish day school league. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Now I'm kind of on the court with them, and it was so fun. Because I was also like, I'm not the... going to be. I let, you know, I played
See,
Kyrie.
You didn't let yourself get embarrassed.
I did not let myself get embarrassed. The following day, we had to shoot some like ISO, a quick little scene with just me and another actor playing basketball. And I was not accomplishing the little task I wanted to accomplish. And I started to get incredibly, ego just started to take over and I got like more embarrassed and short-tempered, and I started to not flow and surf the experience at all. And so I could see myself doing it, but I couldn't stop it.
Isn't that interesting that happened within the confines of sports?
Yeah.
Where that's exactly what happens when, like, a baseball player gets in a slump or something.
Yeah.
And you start becoming your own worst enemy.
Yeah. But I remember it happening with acting of, like, when I first started, like, doing commercials, and my first couple commercials were, like, 30 seconds straight-to-camera monologues for whatever reason, you know? And I just would, like, freeze because I just was, like, overcome by that thing of, like, I can't remember the lines. I'm like, I know the lines, but you just... And I had a therapist tell me to acknowledge my fear, which was very helpful and is what I kind of do before I do anything for the first time or something that I know is scary. And I didn't do it when I was on the basketball court the other day.
Interesting.
But, like, if I do a talk show...
How do you acknowledge your fear? Like, what's the process?
I literally will just say to myself, acknowledge your fear.
Really?
Yeah. It's not an incredibly... But it's like I have... Before I do, like, a live talk show, like, you know, and it's like, you're about to... And now that I've done them enough, I don't have as much of that fear. But, like, like you're about to go out, I'll just be like, acknowledge that you're scared right now, that this is like scary and that you're nervous and that like just like shake its hand and be like, how you doing?
Right.
And your fear is like, I'm scared. And you're like, okay, I got you.
Well, talking about being awkward, talking about those moments of can you be embarrassed? I spent about 7 years waiting for puberty to come.
Yeah.
And when I found out that you were doing this show, which is out on Netflix like now.
Yeah.
And it's called Big Mouth. It's a hard R animated show about puberty. And this show blew me away.
Oh, good.
And when I found out that you created it with your best friend, that you went through this period in your life.
Yeah.
Just talk about the impetus for how the show started.
Yeah, it's based on me and my best friend from childhood, Andrew Goldberg, who we met in first grade and we're friends, and then around middle school became like best friends, inseparable, together every day. We would go home and like watch Wayne's World after school and then host talent shows as Wayne and Garth. And we watched we watched the Mets and we watched Mel Brooks movies and just formed each other's. We saw the first boobs we ever saw on TV was like All That Jazz on PBS.
And you were together.
And we were just together watching it all and like just formed each other's kinds of sensibilities and just cracked each other up. You know what I mean? It was like the first time I'd met another kid who I was like, you make me laugh so hard. And then we stayed friends through high school and college and beyond. And He came to L.A. and became a writer and producer for Family Guy.
It's kind of amazing that you both made it.
It's pretty weird. It's weirdly, in our same grade at school was Julie Klausner, who created Difficult People. It's just like a random small little thing. But we had really gone off on very separate tracks, even though we were both in successfully working in the comedy space. And I became friends with his first bosses, Mark Levin and Jen Flackett, who were a husband and wife writing directing team. They were his first bosses when he moved to L.A. I became friendly with them. I was alone in Mexico City. I leached on to their family and went and saw like Lucha Libre fights with them and their kids.
Really?
Yeah, and just like we just all hit it off. And they came to me one day. They were like, what about an animated show about you and Andrew around seventh grade? And then we just started running with it. It was like, oh, great. Because Andrew was just ravaged by puberty. You know, he was a really early bloomer. He had a full beard, facial hair. His father made his mother wax his upper lip. And for years, he couldn't grow any hair on his upper lip. So like,
because the waxing just killed
it, killed all the roots. So he could grow like a full beard, and then right here was bare. It was like we called it his reverse Hitler.
That's terrible.
But
I envied those guys.
I did too, very much. So like, all of my best friends were, and I was like a super late bloomer. Like I think I got my first pubes around like freshman year of high school.
I'll go you one better. I think I didn't have hair under my arms till senior year of high school. It was so late, I was.
Were you like going to be like, can we see a doctor?
Exactly. I thought, maybe this doesn't happen for everybody.
And did you know, because like what I was doing,
But I'm 75 now.
You look great. It is kind of true, though. Because like the guys who get nailed by puberty early, like, no hair up top.
That's right. We
have hair.
We're destroyed inside, but we have hair.
We're broken enough that we try to succeed in a weird career.
Right.
Which I think does have a lot to do with how I ended up here. Were you clocking other kids? Because like I knew, because my mom's way of dealing with all of it was to tell me about puberty. Like, she'd be like,
she'd go academic on you.
Yes, she'd be like, so what happens when you hit puberty is, like, you have secondary sex characteristics. Your eyebrows grow darker, like, your nipples will become swollen or engorged or something like that. So I'd be like, okay. So I'd be, like, in the locker room being like, what's going on with Sam's nipples?
Swollen?
Yeah. His nipples are pretty swollen. Yeah, he's hitting puberty. You know, and I was just like, I knew what was happening around me, and I knew it wasn't happening to me.
I went to a school where when you hit middle school, everyone's showering together every day. It's required, which was terrible. Mm. So it was just like school every day for me was a minefield of potential embarrassment.
Yes.
Because I was also really short and skinny.
Me too.
And I hated it.
Yeah, it was the worst. I got pantsed in seventh grade. Not deep, you know, when you get your pants taken down. You'd think it would be like adding another pair of pants on, but it's not.
No, pantsed? Yeah. I know. I'm well aware.
But my underwear came down as well, and I got pantsed by a girl in eighth grade who was like deeply developed in front of the girl who I had my crush on from like all of elementary and middle school. So she saw my like little boy dick, and it was, I mean, truly,
to say it now?
Yeah, and I've just made a show entirely about it.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, still very much dealing with, I think we're all dealing with the stuff that happened to us in puberty specifically. That period of adolescence is like you're separating yourself from your parents, like you're creating your own life and identity, and all you're doing all of that while things are happening at a like drastic pace or not happening at all. And all of it is incredibly formative in the person you end up becoming. And so the show is weirdly a very cathartic, like, look back and being like, here's what I'm still dealing with from that age, you know? And like, and here's the stuff that I haven't dealt with.
Yeah, well, I think it's hard when, because everyone's on some sort of a spectrum, and, you know, when you're on the outside edge of either side of it, and maybe that's what's interesting about the show, is that your two lead characters are on opposite ends of the spectrum. Andrew was first, and you were last.
Yeah.
And, you know, what I started wondering about was when you guys started talking about this, you must have shared stuff that you'd never told each other.
Yeah.
Right?
There were definitely things that would have come up.
Like, how did that change your perspective on on your friendship or...
You know, it's like in the first episode of the show is like basically the plot line is Nick scares Andrew after Andrew's taking a shower. His towel falls and he sees his penis. And like most animated shows, we show the 13-year-old boy's penis.
Yeah, no, like no animated shows ever before.
But again, that like throughout making the show, we were always like, well, what are we doing here? If we're making an animated show on Netflix where there are no rules and no regulations.
Well, I'm sure that there will be after this show.
There is a few moments. They gave us. I'm not even going to get into it. It's so disgusting. To even describe it would be.
Garrison Keillor.
There's a beat that went past that in Garrison Keillor.
Okay.
That we were like, that's when Netflix was like, maybe you want to take that out. And we were like, okay.
I don't think I can talk about that moment without changing the standards of this show. Because so far they've said, say whatever you want. But suffice to say, there's a scene where Garrison Keillor is...
the host of Prairie Home Companion.
The most family-friendly human on the planet, right? On NPR.
Yes.
Gets beheaded.
Yes.
And... a hormone monster makes love to his skull.
Yes. That was beautifully phrased, by the way.
And it is disturbing.
Yeah, it might be the... It might... We may have crossed the line on that one.
Oh, you think?
And Garrison, I listened to Prairie Home Companion hungover Sunday for years. I've listened to that show.
I love that you think he's watching this show.
He loves this show. He's in in Minnesota, on Lake Wobegon.
Yeah.
And he's watching this show. I do think maybe Garrison Keillor would watch this show.
Send us a sign, Garrison, if you want.
Please. And it might be hate mail to me. but it's I think we were always like, this is our chance to do the stuff that is crazy to do because it's animation and it was seeing a 13-year-old boy's animated penis. So but it becomes the impetus of what that really felt like, which is of like two boys in very different places. And Nick is feeling very insecure that he hasn't hit puberty. And Andrew is feeling very insecure because he is like ravaged by it. And I think that's how we both felt. And I think it's sort of what drove us in our own ways to do something like this, which is like, this feeling of like angst or whatever it was that then makes you like, I think I got to go make something to figure out how to deal with this feeling.
So how did the process between you two start?
We, Mark and Jen and Andrew came to me with the idea and we started talking about puberty and all that kind of stuff. And then Mark was like, Andrew, I think it was Andrew was like, but there should be some sort of symbol for Andrew of what it feels like when your puberty just takes over like a hormone monster. And Mark was like, yeah, we should have a hormone monster. And then they were, to me, like, we think there should be a hormone monster. And I immediately was just like, touch yourself, Andrew. And like, so...
By the way, his voice is so amazing. It's like a cross between Alec Baldwin and like a goth metal singer.
Yes. Yeah. That's about right. That is the encapsulation of that voice.
And you do many voices on the show.
I do. Yeah, I do a few of different. I do Nick. John Mulaney voices Andrew. And then I do the Hormone Monster. I do Coach Hormone Monster, which comes up in later episodes. And Coach Steve. I do Coach Steve, who's like their gym coach, who is a pretty lonely, who just wants to make friends and wants to hang out.
But you also do the... like the child version of your publicity character.
Yes, I do Lola, who's like a little, she's like, my mom calls me like a dump truck. There was that girl in that grade who was, and it's sort of like in that, it's like the Liz from Publicity. And then, but because it's, yeah, because it's, there's like fillers in each episode where it's like, you know how everybody's been, craving a Joe Walsh impression from the Eagles.
Where has that been on television?
Where is
Tell
it?
You every, came
yeah, there was. I'm just trying to fill that vacuum, that void in the Joe Walsh animated oeuvre. So Joe Walsh, Sylvester.
You did some testing.
What if 13-year-old kids want today, and they want a Joe Walsh impression? I play the Statue of Liberty, like a world-weary French woman who smokes and... gives Jesse, a lot of the stories in the show are based on true stories from me and Andrew's lives, other kids in our grades, or friends, writers, obviously, like the second episode, Jesse gets her period for the first time.
She meets her hormone monster.
Yes, she meets
Maya Rudolph.
Yeah. Who's amazing. And she gets her period for the first time on a class trip to the Statue of Liberty, which really happened to our friend Liz.
Is that true?
Yes. But again, Liz told us this when we started writing the show like a year and a half ago and was like, I got my period for the first time in Statue. We were like, what? So the only artistic difference we added was that we put Jesse in white shorts, which would be every girl's like worst nightmare.
Well, that's what's amazing, and that's what I wanted to understand is like the idea of you and Andrew sitting in a room and sharing these stories, mm-hmm. and sort of finding out that, oh my gosh, this is the most dramatic moment in all of our lives.
Yeah.
And there hasn't really been a show about it that can be this direct about it. Maybe because it's animated, or maybe because it's now you can do that, and there wasn't a platform for it before.
Well, I think there's when we went in and started talking about it amongst ourselves and then pitching it, it was sort of like, it's a perverted Wonder Years. But I do think because of the time and place of being able to be on a streaming service like Netflix where you can do 10 episodes of a show that you are encouraged to create arcs and really let your characters grow and do things and have events affect one another in a way that it's harder to do on like a network animated show where it really just has to kind of restart every week without commercial breaks so that you don't have to create false cliffhangers. In the style of animation with no advertisers that can pull sponsorships.
Right.
So that you can do crazy things like skull intercourse, the severed head of Garrison Keillor. Netflix has been unbelievably cool about letting us do whatever we want. But to tell stories, like there's almost, as you said, I've never thought about it, but like I don't know if there's a more condensed, dramatic time in a person's life than like middle school into the beginning of high school when everybody is in some version of transition in that level. So it's high drama.
And
high
totally relatable.
Yes, totally relatable and high stakes.
Yeah.
And it's like, and ultimately, like hopefully very funny.
Yes.
But it is that like all of that stuff together leads to, I think, really compelling like stories with like really big stakes. The feelings feel big.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, part of me says, okay, of course I see why it's as debauched and hard R as it is, mm-hmm. because it's the most purely funny way to make it happen.
Yeah.
But also, I kind of, from a parent standpoint, because I have a daughter who just entered middle school, like, it would be nice for her to be able to see some version of the hormone monster and this girl and what she's going through.
Yeah.
Because I think there's some parts that they're not played for laughs at all. They're played fully for emotion and for touching your heart. And the first time after Jesse gets her period and the hormone monster comes and sort of like gives her permission to scream at her mom.
Yeah. And call her Shannon.
And call her by her first name and just destroys her mom.
Yeah.
And then she gives her permission to throw herself in the bed and cry.
Yeah.
Like.
So hard, no tears come out.
Yes.
Yeah. No sound comes out, yeah.
Yeah. And it's like, it would be nice to have had that show when I was that age. But there is no way I would let my daughter watch your show.
Well, that's what I'm trying to figure out. Is that it was all leading towards that. And then I'm like, at what age? I mean, I get it. But I also think there are, whatever age you decide to
we'll
let
never
her,
be able to listen to Prairie Home Companion again.
Or you'll listen to it and be like, remember.
Hey, I'm getting a little turned on. Yeah.
I mean, I get turned on anytime I hear Garrison Keillor.
Now.
Now, of course. But it's, my hope is that there is like tools in the show to help parents talk to kids or for even just to help kids understand or navigate that it's like my hormone monster's making me want to do this or I am curious about my penis or my vagina and I want to like I want to understand it all better, or, you know, personifying things that, that I think are inside of us that, like, you know, it would, like, we didn't have, you know? And so, and also, I don't know, it's, I am so curious as to, because I am, for better or worse, telling parents and kids to watch this show together.
Well, you know, there's something collective about that middle school experience and going through it if you sort of had that information that everyone that was feeling this way.
Yeah.
And I think what struck me is seeing the character that was ravaged by puberty going through as many problems.
Yeah.
Because my experience was I figured those guys had it all figured out.
Totally.
You know, you go, it's seventh grade and there's guys that look like adults.
Yeah. You're like, and they're bigger and they're stronger, and whether they're getting girls or not, like, they just seem like sexual beings. And I didn't feel that way. I was like, I want that girl to like me, and I want, like, you know, but it was always like, there's nothing. And I had a girl who, like, the girl who pantsed me made it clear through, like, the rumor mill of middle school that she was ready to, like, give me a hand job or a blow job or something like that. And I was...
This girl is deranged.
Yeah.
First, she's pantsing you.
Yeah, I know. She was...
She's like, I want some of that.
Yeah, I want some of that. And I was like, there's not much of that going on right now.
No, but that experience is traumatic.
It was this weird thing of, like, I'm not ready for that. Or, like, I am ready for that, too, because I know that that's cool, and I bet that would feel good, but also, nothing's going to happen. And I knew that that was, like...
What you also address in the show.
Yes. But that's, like, just kind of what
life.
What life is. It's like, it's weird practice. And I think it's, you know, getting back to the earlier stuff of, like, fear, I think it's, like, the other side of it for me was, like, being, like, a little big mouth, like, a little wise ass, was kind of like, fuck it. Yeah, like, let's go. Yeah, I'm not as big as you guys, but, like, I think I can keep up. You know, like, let's do this. Like, let's roll.
That was your defense mechanism.
I think that was my defense mechanism, and then, which then sort of propelled that kind of attitude. Even when I did catch up, I was still like, fuck it, let's try, let's do it.
Well, you said something a little earlier that I wanted to get back to when you said that that experience may be directly or indirectly responsible for the career you have now.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes me wonder how much that time imprinted itself on you and how much you've had to, like, make peace with it or look at it for what it really was, or...
Well, it's like, I mean, it's crazy because I've gone to a therapist for quite some time, and, like, I would go from my writer's room to my therapist and talk about what we're talking about in the show, because the show is the most autobiographical thing I've ever done. And part of why I was excited about making the show was because I was spending a good amount of time in therapy talking about that age. And so it truly was like an informing one another. And then I'd come into therapy and be like, so Nick has a hormone monster now. And she'd be like, oh yeah, that makes sense. Like, I actually really sort of hit puberty in like ninth grade. And all of a sudden I became the volatile, emotionally uneven kid that a lot of my friends were in like sixth and seventh grade.
Right.
But because you're in ninth grade, there's this whole other version of information that you have or set of circumstances you're dealing with that make that experience of going through puberty slightly different. What's so crazy, though, is like Andrew, who's on such a different side of it, you know, that like was an only child, went through puberty hard and fast, and we went to separate high schools. He went to public school, I went to a private school. But whatever it was at that period of time, we just came together with very varying different circumstances about our lives and just connected. And then have gone back off and then come back to create this thing and connected again. And I think that, I just think we're like an amalgam of our experiences, but the genetic physical maturation of a person is like the girl who pantsed me. And also said she maybe wanted to give me a blowjob, was also like the first girl to get boobs. And so I think she was probably like sexualized at a much younger age to because all of a sudden she became a physical object to men.
Her hormone monster pantsed you.
Yes, that's... yeah, I gotta blame her hormone monster.
Yeah. No, but that, yeah. I mean, that's the brilliant part of the show, I think. Like, did you feel when you hit upon the idea of these manifestations of this thing happening that you really had something
that original? Was sort of a big moment when it was like, there should be a hormone monster. It's called a hormone monster. It immediately became like, it immediately made it be like, this is why this should be an animated show.
Yeah, I think it's great.
Yeah.
I think it's just great.
And, thank you.
I'm disturbed and entertained.
That's all I can ask for. Can we use that as our pull quote?
Yeah. And then
disturbed and entertained. I will not let my child watch this show.
That's right. That'll be the best way to get kids to watch it. So we can't do that.
Kids, all you 13-year-old kids out there watching this show.
Yeah, exactly. I guarantee there's no 13-year-old kids watching this show.
I don't know. We'll see after Big Mouth comes out.
Well, when I was sort of digging into your past, mm-hmm. it seemed to me like you loved comedy so much that you were going to figure out how to do it.
Because
you've talked about this before, but I think it's good to give some context that you come from a pretty well-off family, mm-hmm. and your father was in a very high-intelligence, high-profile job.
My father's Donald Trump. I just Donald get that
Trump.
Out there.
Yeah. And
but no, yes.
You look nothing like him.
I know. Thank you.
No, but it's notable that his business grew exponentially through your childhood.
Yes.
And you guys did well. And a pretty academic family, right? Like all your brothers and sisters went into his business of financial investigation.
Yeah, like corporate investigations and the risk mitigation, as it would be sort of
right. called. And I would look at that and go, okay, you did not follow risk mitigation in your choice of a career.
No.
But people could say, if they look at that on the surface, they could go, he's got a parachute.
Yeah.
He can go try comedy.
Sure.
But I look at it and I go, like, I think artists have to find something to push against. Mm-hmm. And sometimes when you come from means, mm-hmm. there's not as much to push against. And I wonder if you kind of figured out a way to find your thing.
Yeah. No, I think that's very insightful and largely true in that. I think it was the first thing I ever did in my life that I would do anything for it. Like the busy work, anything like going to Kinko's at 3 a.m. to print flyers to put up around campus so that people would come to the improv show. It was like just all the annoying stuff that is not fun to do. Because I think I came from privilege, I didn't really have to do much of that annoying stuff. And so I never did. And then I found comedy, and I was like, oh, I'll do the busy work for this. And I've never stopped saying I'll do the busy work for this. Because ultimately, the thing that I get to do if I do all that stuff is like the most, like, is just continues to be the most, like, joyful thing that I could ever imagine myself doing with my, like, life and career. So that I felt very... But I did have the parachute of knowing, like, well, if this doesn't go well, I can go work for my dad, and I'll be fine, and I'll probably be fine at it. But I didn't have to, so I could go take risks to try to do different things, you know? Then you're, like, playing with house money, kind of, because you're like, okay, I can handle being told I'm not good enough, but I couldn't handle the idea of not knowing whether I was possibly good enough and didn't take the chance.
So all your hard work came down to that idea that
I guess so.
You weren't going to leave a stone unturned.
Sure, but I would also say that all my hard work was due to, like, you could just put it back to, like, being a late bloomer, being like a little shit, and being like, I'll fucking show all of you because, like, I'm just like this little guy and I'm going to, like, figure this out because I've had to figure out how to maneuver through bigger people for years. So it's like, you know, we're all like this amalgam of things, but I think that, like, you know, as I talk about that period of my life, I realized that, like, that stuff is a major engine to it as well.
I identify with that. I think the mindset is, I don't want to be defined the way I think I was defined at that crucial age in middle school or high school of... Oh, he's less than.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I wonder if that's something that sort of sticks to you, too.
For sure.
Yeah.
For sure. It was like, it's different, but you're like, you know, Hitler and Napoleon were little guys. It's like that typical thing of, like, you meet a beautiful woman who has an incredible sense of humor. And she's like, oh, well, I was a completely different physical creature until I was 21 years old.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, so you got to form and become a real, fully functioning person who wasn't like an object until you became a certain age, and so now you've developed all these different muscles. Ashton Kutcher's done well for himself.
He has. He must have been just ugly in high school.
He was probably a real ugly guy.
He didn't grow into his high cheekbones for a while.
No, and that chiseled jaw.
Yeah.
No. But it is. I think we all have, I don't know, I guess we all have our weird little engines, and some of them are very apparent, some of them are, but I do think that particular time is an important one. And I do think in my case, I was very lucky. It's the combination of knowing, because I think a lot of people like enter adulthood and don't know what it is they want to do. Like, I felt very lucky that I knew I wanted to do comedy. Whether I was going to be able to or not was another question, but I felt very lucky that I knew that.
Was there any sense of wanting to make it on your own or wanting to carve your own path away from?
I think so.
Your parents? Like,
yeah, I think so. And my brother still works with my dad. They've been working together for 20 years.
Yeah.
And I have a tremendous amount of respect for my brother for any number of reasons, including like introducing me to comedy and watching all the things that like led me to fall in love with it. But as an adult, like watching him enter into a field that my father's name means so much in is actually a very difficult thing to do, to be able to have like a strong enough sense of self that you could enter another field where your name isn't necessarily the most well known and work within that and then create your own name and create your own identity within that. I don't think my ego would have allowed me to do that.
To go and just be the next Kroll in line.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That I had to be like, I am my own person, which is like a confident thing to do, but also sort of an insecure thing to do.
Yeah, it's funny. It comes across as really confident, but you're right. Maybe that the basis of that is an insecurity.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so you said in something I read or listened to, you said that you've always been fascinated by the machinations of the entertainment industry.
Yeah. I mean, I think... Well, what I think I did get from my dad was while he wasn't in comedy, I watched him like build a company and build stuff and adapt and change, and I got to watch him run a business. And so I'm interested in general in how institutions work in various forms. I don't know if I believe that I know I believe I said that when I just said that, but I don't know if I actually entirely believe that.
It sounded feels, very
yeah.
scholarly.
Yeah, and then I was like, I don't know if that's true. I don't know if I really am fascinated with how
I'm
institutions
trying to
work.
Sound smart.
Yes, but I guess
who should
I'm...
should we attribute that quote to?
Yes. Let's give it to Christian Slater.
Yeah.
Why not?
Hey, you heard
I think
that.
It was Christian Slater who said, I'm really fascinated with how institutions work.
Back when you two were doing Gleaming the Cube.
Oh, my God. Those are the years. But I do think that... I don't love artifice. So I've always been fascinated with institutions, that felt dishonest to me as I'm saying it. So I'm like, I gotta undercut this because I don't believe it. So I think this stuff with like being fascinated with entertainment or how the business works is part of that. Is like, what is the artifice of this and how do we sort of deconstruct it?
Right. I wonder how you became someone who is so, like, would police yourself against artifice. Like, you wonder where that comes from, too, because I feel like I'm the same way.
Yeah.
Like, when I hear myself doing that kind of thing, I always try to undercut myself.
Yeah. It doesn't feel honest. It feels dishonest.
Yeah.
Which is interesting, like, as I've gone through the career and slowly been able to do stuff like this, I never was going to, like, lie about where I came from. But it's not the coolest thing in the world to be like, I come from privilege. But then I start to I'll just be like, I come from privilege, let's get that out of the way, because the last thing I want is to come off as someone who is like, I don't know, shucks, I just like, well, I fell in love with it, and I guess here I am. You know what I mean? Because it's like, there's the internet. Now, I also think the internet, if you do Google me and my father's not worth nearly as much money as the internet claims him to. And that drives me crazy, because I'd love for him to have as much money as the internet says he has.
Right, right.
But he doesn't.
The internet minimizes and maximizes,
yes.
But it's rarely...
It's rarely right in the middle.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's rarely right. So, but again, I like doing the more of these interviews where it's like, all right, well, what should I be saying? How should I be presenting myself? The last thing I want is like, you can fact check and double back on everyone and everything.
Yeah.
So like stripping it away and starting to be more straightforward and honest about stuff seems like the easiest way to be without like worrying about like if you're going to get caught in something. I was like thinking about the fact that right now I actually have a chin strap beard because I'm doing this movie playing basketball and I've got this other thing. And my groomer, who's Sydney, who's wonderfully talented, has put filler in to make me look like I have
a
full...
Was that fake beard?
This is like fake beard along here.
She did a good job.
She did a good job. It looks all right?
Yeah.
Yeah, because it's... I mean, I have like basically, I don't know where the exact line is, but like I have a chin strap beard right along here, and I have some scruff, but it's like a little bit of like...
Wow.
Filler, because I was like, I don't want to be on Sam's show with a chin strap beard and take a picture and look like I've got a chin strap beard. But I was like, as I'm going through being like, yeah, I don't believe in artifice. I'm like,
yeah, I have a fake beard on right now, yeah. But I am so authentic.
Yeah,
exactly. No, you know, it is a thing, though. Like, I think most people wouldn't mention that. They would just sit there and talk very, you know,
yeah,
intelligently about artifice and never mention that.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I like you very much.
Well, I'm very interested in artifice.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. No, let's just jerk each other off. I think it's the environment and interview that you, the tone that you set to make it a place where you want to have a real conversation with someone about this stuff.
Thank God you were speaking metaphorically, because after your show, I thought, is he going to do that?
Yeah, I mean, oh God, everyone's going to think I'm a real weird pervert now.
Oh, you think? After the show you created, people aren't just going to think that's just a show.
That's just a show.
It's you. It's your name.
Yeah.
It looks like you.
Yeah.
No, they aren't going to.
They're not going to make any connection.
No, I think, you know, there's several reasons I think that people become artists or want to be in this kind of business. And I think one of the ones that I relate with the most, and I think it's why you did, is because you want to tell your specific story in ways that people relate. Do you know what I mean?
Like, yeah.
Talking to you and realizing, like, the reason art connects for me is when it really came from a true place.
Yeah. No, I've done a lot of characters over the years because I think it's easier to sort of hide behind a character in a way of like, you can just be like, I know this character's point of view. It's much easier to just be like, I'm going to like create my little story for this person. But kind of figuring out what your story is can be a little more complicated, especially if I don't love like people's clean little narratives that they create.
Yes.
And I've largely done characters and played characters because I've been either scared or not interested in my own, in whatever my little story is. And this became, very much felt like the most, well, most autobiographical, but it felt like a good vehicle to really examine all that stuff and tell a lot of my stories that way.
Well, you know, when I look at your timeline, and there's so much that you've done that we haven't discussed, but The Kroll Show and The League ended at around the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems almost like you made a deliberate pivot or put a period on that part. And I read something where you said that that is a frightening position to be in, where you're waiting for someone else to hire you and see your potential. And you sort of took that, you know, you took that upon yourself to change that. And I think that's pretty amazing.
Thank you. Yeah, I think I just... again, I don't know if it comes out of a place of like fear or insecurity. Be like, I don't know if I'm good enough or if people can see what I can do, so I have to do it myself to show them that I can do it. But I think it's just in general, it's empowering to just take that control. And the people whose careers I respect and like artists that I admire are people who I think do that, who keep kind of evolving and doing things themselves, showing people that they can do it, and then doing it either for themselves or with other people. But I think it's like, I never trusted that, like, that it would just be, even though I've had a lot of stuff handed to me in my life, that I was going to be handed the stuff that I wanted to do professionally. I mean, I think even though I didn't go into my dad's business, my dad was an entrepreneur, and my dad always says about me and my friends that we're, in his mind, we're entrepreneurs, that artists are, in fact, very entrepreneurial. They have to be, even though whether they consider themselves businessmen or not, or businesswomen, whatever, that you are looking for a something in the marketplace that isn't there and then filling that, you know? And so I think I always looked at, in a weird way, looked at what I was doing in that, in sort of like that, where it's like, there hasn't been an animated show about puberty that goes really far in talking about these things. Like, let's go make that. There hasn't been like a sketch show. I mean, there have been versions of it that are semi like narrative and function, like Seth Meyers, who I will name drop as a friend of mine, sort of called the show like sketchuational comedy. And I sort of made fun of him for it at the time, but I actually really liked it, which is like this hybrid of kinds of shows. So like, that's no different than being like, you know, they don't make lollipops in kale flavor yet. I bet there's a space in the market for that.
Right, right.
Like a kid lollipop, but it's kale, it's healthy.
Yeah. No, it makes
sense.
By the
way, let's go fucking make that.
Yeah, that's sounds terrible. You should stick to making puberty animated shows.
I think I will, which is why I've ended up where I am.
I think you should make a kale lollipop so we can find out.
Will we call it a kale-pop? It would be like, it would have the consistency of like steamed kale, but it would be hard enough like a lollipop. Because what do kids want more?
And it delicious. Just leaves you with bad breath and a green tongue.
Isn't that matcha, basically?
Basically, yeah.
I don't like matcha.
I don't like it either.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I get it.
Well, wherever it comes out of, I mean, the end result is that you're making something original.
Yeah, it's been really super cool doing it with Andrew. I like that when I, like, look at my life right now, there are a lot of things I'm very happy, pleased, and grateful for. And one of them is making the show with someone who I'm like, oh, this person who I've known for over 30 years, I'm still friends with, and I had never, have not worked with since like a lip sync competition of Queen's Don't Stop Me Now at like a campfire 20 some odd years ago. And then like we then get back together and create a show together and are still like, and are better and stronger friends than we have been in since like middle school.
Seems to me like you've kind of put your head down for the last 15, 20 years and worked really hard. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if reconnecting with an old friend like that and looking at your past, if it's made you sort of reassess your life work balance a little bit.
Yeah, it's tricky. You know, Andrew's interestingly is like married with two kids. I'm single and I mean, I have a very strong family, but I'm like a single person with no kids. And so there are moments where I'm like, look at him and he goes home to his wife and kids and has a very different life than mine. And I think he probably at times looks at my life and sees like, oh, that would be fun to be doing as well. So like it's the sort of the dichotomy of that relationship of like wanting what the other one has is still there.
Right.
But I think the nicest thing is like, I think we're both enjoying the version of lives that we've chosen for ourselves.
Right, right.
And that's pretty cool. I don't know about slowing down. I mean, I've yet to like have a long vacation and like it as much as I have like make the art that I want to make.
Yeah, well that right there, that's the definition of success.
Yeah.
If your work is better than your vacation.
Yeah.
Well, listen, it's been fascinating to talk to you. I think that I wasn't prepared for Big Mouth, and it really kind of threw me because I wasn't expecting to find something that was entertaining on a really base level and also sort of psychologically comforting in a weird way and disturbing. But I think you're doing really cool work, and I'm glad to get to know you a little
bit. Thank you very much. I really appreciate it. I'm a big fan of the show, so I've been pleased to talk to you.
Well, thank you for doing it. And come back
And next week?
Yeah, okay. Next week.
I'll come back next week.
We don't have anyone for next week.
Great. I'll come back. Let's talk about me. Great.
Can we do it in, like, characters?
Yeah, I'll come back as a character.
I'd love to do that.
Yeah.
I'd love to be someone other than myself for, like, a day.
Do you want to be Bobby Bottle Service?
Sure. Could I get a chin strap beard?
Yeah, I was going to say, we'll just shave your beard down.
I'm ready.
Yeah. And I could give you my the weird makeup that I've put on.
Yeah, well, I want to know how to do that.
Oh, come on, I'll show you.
All right, let's go.
Well, folks, that's our show. Thanks for listening. You know, this show really brought back some vivid memories for me of being in middle school and high school and not knowing what was going on and being insecure and feeling like I was never going to figure things out. And that time's really hard to talk about, but I found this conversation one of the most fascinating we've ever done. And ultimately, that's what art is for, right? It's to bring us all together and to make us realize our experience on this earth is a shared experience. And for that, I want to thank Nick Kroll for being so honest, for creating this wonderfully disturbing show, and, you know, for sharing the fact that he was pantsed, because that couldn't have been easy. As someone who was taped to a tree in high school, I sympathize. And if you want to sympathize with Off Camera, go to offcamera.com and go check out our store. We make a magazine for every guest. It's in beautiful black and white. It goes great on your coffee table, and it's a perfect way to support the show. Another great way to support the show and to have every episode we've ever done at your fingertips on any device, anytime you want to watch them, is by getting the off-camera monthly subscription. For just $4.99 a month, you can watch every episode we've ever done, and there's no better way to experience the show. So check that out. Support off-camera. Tell your friends about us. If you're liking what we're doing, don't keep it to yourself. Spread the word. I want to thank everyone that helps out on this show. Crawford Shippey, Michaela Galvin, Laura Kemper, Nathan Shields, Amy Jones, Cara Johnson, and Matt Davidson, who is a genius with a plunger and a coat hanger. So thank you, Matt, for all the work you do around here. If you want to reach out to us, tweet about us, Instagram about us, or just talk about us to the greater social community, we are Off Camera Show on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And I am Sam Jones on Twitter and Sam Jones Pictures on Instagram. Or you can email me. I'd love to hear guest suggestions and personal stories and any comments about the way the show has affected your life. My email is sam@offcamera.com. And be sure to join me next time when I sit down with actor Chadwick Boseman.
If you're making movies and you're doing well, people say, oh, he's the next Denzel. Making your success based upon the idea that there can only be one of you. You know, I root for Idris Elba. I root for David and Michael. And I root for everybody because I know if they do well, it presents an opportunity for me. The studio will say, hey, that kind of movie worked. Let's do another movie like that. It's all about the stories and people saying these stories are valid.
Chadwick didn't set out to make a career of starring in biopics about African-American icons. In fact, he didn't exactly set out to be an actor. Yet he's played Jackie Robinson, James Brown, and most recently, Thurgood Marshall. He joins me to talk about the physical and artistic challenges of those roles, as well as the insecurities that fueled his amazing performances in them. With his career about to explode in Marvel's upcoming Black Panther, he's not exactly scrambling for roles. That said, if you've got a script about a smart, lovable serial killer, he's listening. See you next time, off camera.